it please the court, Josh Lazar for the Garassi Law Firm, representing appellant Carolyn Lazar. I would respectfully request to leave 5 minutes of balance of my time for rebuttal. Or if the court terminates its questions, which is probably unlikely before then. This case is 27 years in the making. The seeds were sown back in 1990 when the Uniform Probate Commission took what it deemed a rational step by deciding to expand the revocation of spouses and wills to non-probate assets. Almost immediately, the Eighth Circuit held that it could not be constitutionally applied to a contract signed before the statute, and a statute there which was nearly identical to the model statute 2804. And since then, the state Supreme Courts, four of them, have been split, two holding it unconstitutional under the Contracts Clause, two holding constitutional, and as Your Honor knows, there is a split in the circuits now because of the Tenth Circuit opinion.
So if obviously, if you have to choose sides and then split, to me, the question that I'd like you to address is the cases seem to turn on whether or not there is a vested right, some sort of property right that's being taken today by the ROD statutes. That's a question of state law, isn't it?
Well, if I may answer the first part of your question first and then get to the
There's only one part. The part was, is the question whether or not property right exists a question of state law?
Generally, Your Honor, but insofar as it impacts standing, it brings in a third-party standing.
And by the way, I'm not interested in the standing issue on this question. My personal view is that your client had standing. My question is, if this does turn on whether or not your client had vested property right, how do we determine whether or not she had such a right?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully would like to modify.
You have to answer my question first. Don't we determine what your client's rights were with respect to this IRA by reference to state law?
Your Honor, her ex-husband had property rights, contract rights as well.
Right, and you're not representing him.
Your Honor, I believe we have third-party standing, and numerous courts have upheld the third-party standing, including Whirlpool, and two of the cases cited by the other side. Third-party standing has been upheld, and even in cases which are ruled.
I'm assuming you have independent standing.
Okay.
You're not here on behalf of his estate. His estate is separately represented.
But, Your Honor, we can't assert the rights of Tom Sprocky on third-party standing that's been upheld in Whirlpool and two other cases cited by the estate. In fact, the Whirlpool decision was based upon the rights of the ex-spouse.
And I know you want to take me on a frolicking detour. I still want to ask you the question. Whatever property rights are issued, let's assume you're talking about the husband's property rights for a second, are they or are they not determined by state law?
Not with respect to her rights under the IRA. That's a federal law question.
So your view is that determining whether or not she had a right to collect under the IRA is governed by federal law?
I believe yes, so, and it preempts
the federal law governance.
Well, I'm glad you asked it.
So I'm going to get answered.
Yeah. Well, you have to start with the statute. And the statute is 26408A and says that the IRA account is created for the exclusive benefit of the individual and the beneficiary.
So how do we determine who the beneficiary is? Is there any federal law that tells us how we determine who the beneficiary is?
Absolutely, and it'll take me 5 or 6 minutes to go through it.
No, you don't have 5 or 6 minutes to go through it. I don't want a 5 or 6 minute answer to this question.
Well,
tell me what statute tells me how I determine who the beneficiary is.
There are regulations both under the IRA code, which are cited in our brief, and under ERISA, which has a specific.
So let me ask you, I've read all the ones you cite in your brief. I don't find anything in federal law that says that the person first listed as a beneficiary remains such, even though state law may say that the beneficiary has changed by operation of law. Is there anything in federal law which meets the question that you're posing to the district?
all of
the things that say the beneficiary gets the IRA. My question is there anything, and can they really prevail on any of those? So this is not a hostile question. I'm asking a different question. Is there anything that in federal law that directly addresses the question before us today?
I think it's been addressed by all the Supreme Court cases, because what they say is if the federal law and regulations say that we are going to honor the intent of the donor spouse, whether it's insurance policy, federal insurance policy, benefit program, under that program, and dealing with the last nail in the coffin, it says we are going to honor that, and that person gets the benefits. And I believe it was Justice Thomas and Hillman which says, if you are distributed the benefits, that means you get to keep on them. And there's a straight line of cases, and they all deal with the applicable federal statutes and regulations, and there are a circle of regulations.
Can you say all IRAs are developed by federal law and state laws, not federal
law? No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that the regulations under the IRA and those which have been adopted from the distribution rules from ERISA, which carry with them ERISA's definition of a beneficiary under 29-10028, which has specifically been adopted for IRAs as evidenced in the publications 590A and 590B, and that tells you who is entitled to the money. It says right there, a beneficiary designated under the plan is one who is entitled to the benefits. It couldn't be clearer, and I'll be happy to give the court the citations after.
You're in your brief. I still need an answer to my question. Do any of these regulations confront the kind of situation we have here, where by operation of state law, the beneficiary changes?
Your Honor, that was addressed directly in Engelhoff. The argument was raised in his dissent by Justice Breyer, and it was addressed in a footnote by Justice Thomas in Engelhoff. And what Justice Thomas said is, there is no statute written, especially ERISA statute, which is written 16 years before the first OOD law was ever even thought up in 1990. There is no statute which Congress can write which can come up with hypotheticals to address anything which is going to happen in the future or any possible situation. So the statutes are drafted based on the understanding of the law at the time. No one thought that there would be this kind of interference in state law. There is nothing in the regulations which allow for it. And
we're dealing in Engelhoff with ERISA preemption.
And there is just as much preemption from the regulations which have the force of statute in the IRA law as the regulations.
Do you say for that?
The general conflict preemption law says, well, to request law says,
it's not the Supreme Court law that says ERISA law preempts all contrary state law, correct?
And it's also been adjudicated to override it by conflict preemption. It has nothing, you don't need under bonds, you don't need the preemption clause, and under general Supreme Court jurisprudence, including Hillman, which disposed of the preemption clause, they said, we're going to decide this by conflict preemption. You do not need a preemption clause to rule that a state law which interferes is overridden by state law preemption. And the conflict here is stark and simple. Under the plan, which says you have to pay the last designated beneficiary on file in a form acceptable to the custodian. And that plan cannot be amended without the Secretary's approval.
So is it your position in this case that it really doesn't matter whether or not you can meet the burden imposed by California? So if we were to choose the California statute, you'd be entitled to show that notwithstanding the statute, it was the real intention of the decedent to leave the money to your client. Your position is, I don't even have to meet that burden, right?
That's correct, because
it doesn't matter which state law we choose to be applicable, because your view is that no state law is applicable.
choice of law questions might come up in collateral issues, but not on the issue of the ownership of the IRA. It's overridden.
No, no, I'm not talking about the issue of who the money goes to.
No.
Your view is that the choice of law issue is irrelevant because no state law can be applicable to this.
You can't interfere with the pre-distribution phase, which is what all these cases say.
No, I understand. And really, I'm not trying to be hostile. I want to understand the position because a lot of the brief is devoted to choice of law. Your view is that
doesn't matter for purposes of distribution because it's a preemption question.
So your argument with respect to the contract clause is that the contract that Mr. Lazard entered into with the IRA company is being impaired and that no state law can change that.
No state law can retroactively impair the rights of either Mr. Kroenke as the signer of the IRA or Mr. Zahn's a third party beneficiary. I'm at 4 minutes. May I reserve?
You can serve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, T.J. Ryan on behalf of Mark Kronk in his capacity as the personal representative of the estate of George Thomas Kronk. I think some framework is necessary to assist the Court in this question. In 2008, Mr. Kronk divorced his wife, Carolyn Lazar, and in doing so availed themselves of Arizona law. And when they did that, Arizona's revocation non-divorce statute did two things. It revoked his then-revocable beneficiary designation that was then in favor of his ex-spouse, and it also, on Lazar's side, she disclaimed her interest in the IRA account. So it operates two ways.
Well, but I understand what the law does. What your opponent says is that law can't override federal law, which says that a state law can't take away a beneficiary designation. I think that's a fair summary of at least part of what he said. So respond to that for me.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And he's correct in general. And there are multiple types of preemption, as the Court's well aware. Express preemption and conflict preemption are the two types of preemption that he's arguing.
The rest we're dealing with express preemption.
That's absolutely correct. And I think one of the pieces of this that has to be understood is that in the regulations, the federal regulations that apply to ERISA, which are Department of Labor statutes, not tax statutes, but Department of Labor statutes, specifically exempt IRAs from the application of Title I. The express preemption statute contained in Title I of ERISA. And in fact, in the appellant's opening brief, he admits that ERISA does not apply. What he tries to do is shoehorn ERISA through the back door of the 401A9 regulations. And the 401A9 regulations do one thing and one thing only, and that is explain what rubric an individual beneficiary or an individual account owner of a retirement account, whether it's a ERISA account or an individual retirement arrangement, how fast they must withdraw the assets that they've been allowed to defer taxation on. That's it.
Here's the question I asked your colleague here. I know there's lots of law out there, two circuit decisions about this contract clause issue, but is there any law about this preemption issue? With respect to IRAs, with respect to ERISA contracts right now, I know he's arguing from analogy, but I'm trying to find out if there's a case anywhere that says that the ERISA, that the IRA regulations preempt state law with respect to the definition of beneficiary.
That the IRA regulations preempt state law? No. There's something in the inverse in the Ninth Circuit's decision in Tiberico, which says that very clearly IRA beneficiary designations are not controlled by the ERISA regulations. And it cites to that Department of Labor regulation that exempts IRAs.
It says they're for a different purpose.
That's exactly correct. Now, Your Honor, you brought up a good point earlier, which is that IRAs are a function of state law. In fact, 408A says that they are a trust, and a trust is an element an animal of state law. So as an animal of state law controls its disposition. And that's the outcome here, is the trial
which state law controls the disposition of this.
In my view, Your Honor, it's very simple. Tom Kronk was a decedent in Arizona. Arizona controls the disposition of his assets.
Well, this case was brought in Arizona.
I was born in California.
I was born in Arizona. So the district judge in sitting in diversity is supposed to apply Arizona law.
That is correct. I believe it was actually signed in Colorado. But at the time of his death in 2012, he was the domiciliary of Arizona. And in fact, I don't believe that he was domiciled in Arizona when he signed it. In fact, if we assume for the moment that federal law does not apply and we're choosing between Arizona law and California law, even if we choose California law, because Tom Kronk died as president of Arizona, California law defers to Arizona. But as Judge Reyes identified in what I think is a very well-organized and well-reasoned opinion, somewhat of a roadmap for this court to follow, potentially, is that Arizona law says, hang on a minute, if we're choosing state law to apply, we're going to examine the chosen state law, and if it conflicts, we're going to keep it here in Arizona.
Right, and there's a specific statute.
2703.
And there's a specific Arizona statute that deals with the revocation of divorce.
Correct.
That's a state policy.
Absolutely.
As identified in the other statute.
Absolutely.
Okay. But don't we still have the question then of could an Arizona statute under the contracts clause take away vested rights from, I was thinking of the spouse, but I guess your opponent thinks that it's taking away vested rights from
Well, it depends on the question. And the question here, the original argument was that it took away her vested rights, Lazar's vested rights. But as the stream of cases that have come down in the wake of the Whirlpool case, being distinguished from Whirlpool, including Stillman and all of its progeny out of the Tenth Circuit, they've all explained that there is nothing more than a contingent expectancy. And if we look at the facts of this case, the question is, what could have Tom Kronk done in order to avoid the effects of the statute? And he had multiple options to avoid the effects of the statute. Number one, in the divorce decree, he could have indicated that the beneficiary designation in favor of Lazar would remain. Number two, he could have redesignated Lazar after the fact, at any time, correct. The trial court's order that dissolved their marriage and terminated their joint property rights could have dealt with this issue. Frankly, they could have remarried. That would have also trumped the statute as well. So in terms of an exercise of legislative expression, it didn't affect in any way Kronk's ability to change his contract or handle his IRA.
Right. I suppose it affected in the sense that it said to him, you better do this before you die.
Correct.
I've read the divorce decree or the dissolution decree and the settlement. It's fair to say there's nothing in there about this, is that right?
Well,
you're teasing intentions, but it's not directly the message.
Not at all. And in fact, that's exactly what the statute is intended to address, which is inattentiveness. Far cry from the express intention that is required, even if we assume that California law were to apply. And I would even posit that on the basis of the pleadings, the case could be upheld even under California law analysis because the allegations did not lead to an express expression of intent. But the question you asked was,
the question I asked was through the divorce papers.
Thank you.
And you and I agreed that there's nothing in it that directly deals with this. I think you were about to tell me how I should interpret them to deal with this. If I can make your argument for you.
Well, no. The divorce decree, Your Honor, actually does address and it split the IRA. What it did not do was address the beneficiary designation.
So she got ownership of him, right?
Correct. But in that same divorce decree, in that same property settlement agreement, they both mutually waived any interest in any of the other's assets. And again, as the revocation and divorce statute operates, Lazar was treated as having disclaimed her interest. So it falls in lockstep.
That's the question I was trying to focus on before, which is that the divorce decree may have done away with her interest in any of his assets. The question is whether she had an enforceable property interest in
her assets.
In the designation of herself as a beneficiary.
Well, that is based on the predicate that an individual who is freely changeable by the contract owner, Kronk is the contract owner, if they have any property rights, and the uniform analysis has been no. Whirlpool has been criticized over and over and over again. And I want to touch on one point. Mr. Lazar indicated that the law analyzed for Whirlpool was substantially similar to 2804, which is based on the Uniform Probate Code. That is not true. And if you analyze the language of the statute as it exists in Whirlpool, that was an incredibly expansive statute that went so far as to say that all elements of a contract are revoked, not the beneficiary designation, but the contract itself. And there's another distinguishing factor that I think is important in Whirlpool. That was a life insurance case. And as Whirlpool discussed, they went on and on about how life insurance has one purpose, to provide assets to a beneficiary. And using that as force to uphold the beneficiary designation, even in light of the revocation of the divorce statute, they found that persuasive. This is not their case. This is an IRA. And I think it's universally understood that an individual retirement account is not an estate planning tool. It's a retirement vehicle. It's a way to defer your otherwise taxable income so that you can use it later when, arguably, your taxable income is lower.
Let me return to Whirlpool for a second. What struck me about both the Eighth Circuit and Tenth Circuit cases is they seem to look back to state law to figure out what the property interest or not was of the beneficiary. I can't say the Eighth Circuit was wrong about Arkansas law. They know Arkansas law better than I do. So my question is, are the cases conflicting in that sense, or did they just come to different conclusions about what state law provides?
Well, if we're analyzing this case under Arizona state law, Arizona has been clear in its expression in the Dobert case that there is no vested right. So while at the time that they divorced in 2008, the Dobert case explains that there was no vested right, and therefore there was no contractual impairment.
The district court initially in California, and to some extent Judge Reyes adopted this, although he moved on to the merits, found no standing here. Surely, Ms. Lazar is standing to assert her own entitlement to this, doesn't she?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor, because I think in some ways the contractual rights and the standing analysis somewhat blurred together.
That gets to the merits. There's Article 3 standing. She says, I have a property right. I've been denied the property right. You can fix it, court. You can give me my money. This class of Article 3 standing, at least with respect to her own entitlement to collect this money, isn't there?
Well,
she may fail on the merits, but they may win on it, but surely there's standing.
Well, Your Honor, selfishly, I think if you say there's no standing, then I've been doing this for now 4 years for nothing. But
well, there's no standing, then nobody should have ever reached the merits of the claim.
Also true. Correct. So from that standpoint, the analysis of standing was, I think, among many arguments that were made to try to attempt to block the case.
Well, but I ask because we have no jurisdiction to reach the merits of a case if it's an Article 3 standing. It seems to be rather clear that Ms. Lazar has Article 3 standing to assert her own claim, whether or not, put aside for a second whether she's asserting a claim on behalf of Mr. Kronk, but surely her own claim she has Article 3 standing for, doesn't she?
Well, on the basis of the face of the documents, yes, Your Honor, that there's been, she was named and an injury can be alleged, therefore. So in analyzing the case, Your Honors, I think it's important to understand that Arizona's revocation on divorce statute did not affect any of Tom Kronk's contractual rights. He had the ability at any time to redesignate Mrs. Lazar if that was his express intent, but that's not what the statute is aimed at. The statute, as explained in Dobert and Lamparella, is aimed at ejection. Supplementing and making an assumption, admittedly it is an assumption, but supplementing what occurs when two parties get divorced. And supplementing that order that the judge enters. And again, California property law will kick the issue back to Arizona. Again, I want to reiterate that ERISA does apply here, and my opponent has admitted that none of those cases really meet the question on the merits, and ultimately the disposition of the assets are subject to state law. the IRA regulations, I believe I made this point earlier, it's important to understand where in the code these regulations fall. The IRA regulations, both 408A and its reference to 401A9, are tax regulations. Correct, it's a deferral taxation. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. It's a deferral taxation. But what they say is, if we're going to, the legislative purpose, Congress's purpose is, if we're going to allow you to defer your taxation on these assets, we're going to require that you pull them out so that they are subject to tax on a schedule that we set. Now, as the 401A9 regs also say, they contemplate the application of state law. Because this is a trust and an animal of state law will apply in terms of identifying who may be the beneficiary. And I want to make one last point, which is that the use of the term designated beneficiary, the trial court identified that as a term of art, and I think that's an absolutely proper and apt description. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Commissioner Lazzari, you have 355.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to touch briefly on the Commerce Clause because of some of the argument I heard. We haven't touched on that today. I agree with the court that Ms. Lazar does have Article 3 standing to assert the Commerce Clause claim. This contract, which is noted in the record by the papers that were actually signed, was signed by Mr. Bunky in Colorado, countersigned by Schwab in California. Under standard California, that means it was entered into in California. We have a contract entered into in another state, which Arizona is trying to reach across its state borders and drastically change the terms, forbid the payment of
dormant commerce clause.
Exactly. And the test under extraterritorial commerce clause section, unlike other sections of the commerce clause where you have to weigh the local interest, as the court knows from its opinion in San Francisco, it's a strict kind of liability standard. Once you cross the state borders in order for the Commerce Clause to survive, you have reached beyond your ability to control another state's law. So I think we've clearly stated here a Commerce Clause claim was entered into in California. Arizona is attempting to change the beneficiary. It's attempting to insert a provision, which it can't even get by federal law without amendment. And the provision would be that divorce revokes the stated beneficiary. You can revoke the plan terms, which again, Your Honor, and I can't emphasize this. Tom Brockie had 7 days under federal regulations to look at those, to decide whether he wanted to opt out. The secretary enacted these so that the person with the plan would be informed of the provisions to act on them. We don't know that Tom Brockie even knew of the Arizona law, but we do know that he had a federal right to act on what was in front of them. But the Commerce Clause would bar, under Article 3 standing, application of this contract at all. And Judge Reese could have granted leave to amend on that. He decided to decide the issue. And we believe it was basically an open and shut issue. You can't have a local state law under, whether it's also law provision or other, which defeats a Commerce Clause claim. If that was the case, the local state interest in Healy would have defeated the Commerce Clause claim, and every Supreme Court case dealing with extraterritoriality would have defeated it, and the artist's interest in California and San Francisco would have defeated the claim, and yet the court found that there was violation. As far as the waiver argument, Your Honor, I believe I said that in my papers, raising the issue of waiver here in terms of counsel's comments is improper because they reserve that issue if this case goes back to remand, and it's a complex issue. But I want to point out that under 2625108, there can't be a waiver of the IRA without signing a qualified disclaimer, and there's no evidence that there ever was a qualified disclaimer.
But that doesn't this go to what I heard from counsel that occurred to me. Your client's asserting Mr. Kirk's interest in
hers.
Hers, I understand, a perfect Article 3 statement. But if he's disclaimed any interest in any of his property, how can she assert his interest?
Your Honor, he had a contractual interest to name the beneficiary and have that contract.
I understand that perfectly, but if the divorce decree says, I give up all other interests in any of his property, contractual interest for property, How does she then have standing to assert his interests?
Your Honor, we're getting into the scope of waiver issue, but the answer...
I'm not getting into the scope of waiver. I'm getting into the effect of the Arizona divorce decree. That's different than waiver.
The answer is she's not claiming part of the marital estate under the divorce. That was divided. She's claiming her rights as a contractual beneficiary just as a stranger.
And that one I understand perfectly. When you said, and the reason I'm asking this, I'm taking your overtime, but I'm being useful enough in the answer to it, is that you said she's interested, she's asserting his rights, third-party standing, right?
And her rights.
Okay, her rights are fine with respect to his rights. His rights are property rights.
Contract
rights. Did she disclaim all interest in any of the marital estate's rights at the time of the divorce?
Well, Your Honor, now we're getting into the scope of the waiver, which is not her waiver.
It's just simply a matter of interest.
She did not.
A divorce decree.
She did not disclaim or could disclaim. She could not disclaim legally. She could not disclaim. She could not prevent his right to rename her as a beneficiary once they parted and had their separate assets.
Right. They were entirely his rights.
His rights.
Not hers anymore.
She gave up her rights to the division of the marital estate. They got, whoever got their share, and they walked away. Each side was entirely free to designate whoever they wanted. And under federal law, that designation had already been made. It was in a plan which could not be amended, and this state law is a way around honoring the plan and around the fact that you cannot get that revocation clause in there without an amendment, without approval by a secretary, without 30 days after that giving it to
Trump. You're answering a different question than what I asked.
I'm sorry.
But I understand your position.
I'm going to get another question. I'm sorry.
You've gone over, and I think, to be fair to both sides, you're going to give the argument time relatively equal. So thank you. I appreciate your arguments. Thank you. Unless anybody has any other questions, the case is submitted.